focused on cancer stem cells and CIRM awardees, grantees. So a really exciting series of...
I started to see Dr. Jameson back in, 2010, 2011. I have a rare form of blood cancer. It's called myelofibrosis. And when I started to see Dr. Jameson, I was actually getting pretty, really sick with that, from that disease. And at the time, there weren't a lot of treatment options, but I was referred to Dr. Jameson because she was running a trial for a new treatment, and she was able to get me on that trial.
How did you feel about that? I mean, experimental therapies are promising in many ways, but they're experiments. I mean, how much did she explain to you about the amount of the dose you would get? Because sometimes in early stage clinical trials, you're not getting what's considered the optimum dose. You're given a safe dose just to make sure it doesn't do any more harm.
Yes, it was, at the time, I was actually quite afraid of seeing doctors, of going to medical institutions. Like, my experience had just been really rough, but I was really getting sick. And I knew that I needed to overcome that fear of going to hospitals and being treated. That said, also combine it with an experimental treatment. But, when you're really in a position where you need something that doesn't exist yet, I felt also that this was an opportunity to really, have hope, right? Get a chance to be on something that could work where nothing was available.
Did the fact that it was being done at an academic medical center, a big place like UC San Diego, did that help reassure you in any way?
Oh, most definitely. The combination of going to the Morse Cancer Center, which they are amazing to their patients. I just always had the warmest reception from absolutely everyone I interacted with. Combined with, it's one of the top medical institutions around. So, if there was a chance for a treatment like this, then it was there.
What happened afterwards? How quickly did you start to feel better?
It was pretty amazing. I had really low expectations, from how sick I was and that it was experimental, and cancer. You just expect to really, you expect it to be awful, and. My experience was the exact opposite of all of my expectations. I started to feel incredible within a few months, like the pain and the side effects from my actual cancer started to come down, while the side effects from the drug just weren't very prevalent. I had a little bit of upset stomach and some nausea. But, compared to what I was experiencing from the cancer, it was a walk in the park.
Did you know much about stem cell research before all of this?
I really didn't. This sort of thing is not my background. And when I first got diagnosed, I went on, I tried to find out as much as I possibly could about the disease. But it's so rare, there just wasn't a lot out there. And I remember reading about some sort of gene discovery called the JAK2 that was connected with my disease. But, at the time, it just seemed so far-fetched to get from, some discovery of a genetic mutation to, something I could actually use or be treated with. But shockingly, it became a treatment option. So quickly, within a matter of years, which, again, it's just unbelievable and amazing.
How do you feel about being a pioneer in something? I mean, do you feel a responsibility now to talk about this all the time?
You know, it's funny. I don't think of myself as a pioneer. You know, there's an army of researchers and doctors and people that have come together to make this drug possible. They are the pioneers. I feel both blessed to have the chance to be connected with these folks. And you know, if anything, if you know, my participation in this trial has it's helped me, but the opportunity that it could help other people is truly meaningful to me.
Well, I mean, all that great work that the researchers do, if it doesn't help people like you, it's up for nothing. So yes, you are very much a pioneer. Sandra, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
'Thank you very much for inviting me to speak here. I'm going to be talking about targeting stem cell signals in therapy-resistant cancers and solid and heme malignancies. And I'll just start sort of generally with the idea that we have for many years now been interested in how pre-malignant lesions with additional mutations become malignant. And one of the things that we've worked on is not as much proliferation or cell death, which are actually aberrant in both states, but the fact that there's a state change that occurs when premalignant lesions become malignant, and they undergo a differentiation arrest and are unable to differentiate further. So if you think about development, where normally you go from being immature to being mature, in this case, it's as if these mutations are really unraveling all the programs that were put in place during development, so that these cells become more immature collectively. So you can think of this sort of in development in reverse. So in thinking of this as development in reverse, one of the things that we've done in context of trying to understand this is look at stem cell signals, which, as you know, are high early in development, and they fade or are extinguished with differentiation. And we and many other labs have shown that in cancer, as premalignant lesions can be fairly low in the stem cell programs, but these are elevated or hijacked and activated as the cancer becomes more aggressive. So the idea of studying this really long term is that if we understood the signals that are turned on to drive this premalignant lesion to a full-on malignancy, those may be used as a molecular basis for enabling early detection. And if we knew the signals that are needed to take this premalignant lesion to a full-on malignancy, it may be a strategy for early interception. And many of the pathways and drugs that, as a community, we have discovered could be very well be effective or more effective early on. And one of the challenges has been really that we use a lot of these drugs or interception of these programs too late in disease. So in looking at stem cell programs, one of the pathways that we've been very interested in is an RNA-binding protein called MUSASHI, and this was originally identified at Hopkins as an RNA-binding protein in during Drosophila development. And when it's mutated or there's a loss of function created, instead of one bristle and a neuron, these flies get two bristles. And because of its double bristle phenotype, it was named Musashi after this iconic Japanese samurai who used to fight with two swords. And we had found several years ago that Musashi was actually very low in chronic phase disease and that it rose as disease became more and more aggressive in chronic myeloid leukemia, stepping through accelerated phase into blast crisis. So we had done work showing that if you block Musashi either through shRNA delivery or through a genetic allele, you can gain in survival in these models in leukemia growth, and also that patient samples that were in blast crisis would respond to blockade in Musashi. So one of the things that we'd noticed at the end of that work was that Musashi was in fact not just high in heme malignancies, but also in a lot of solid cancers. And this included aggressive cancers like GBM, high-grade breast cancer, colon cancer, and lung cancer, but no one really knew what its role was. So we started to work with Andy Lowy, who's a pancreatic surgeon, on pancreas cancer, which, as you know, is a lethal and deadly disease. with very few options currently and much in need of a sort of altered clinical landscape. So we studied this to understand whether Musashi and other stem cell programs may be relevant in pancreas cancer progression, partly because if you look at how pancreas cancer progresses, it goes from being highly differentiated, although dysplastic, into a more malignant adenocarcinoma, which is fairly undifferentiated. And so we took a model of pancreatic cancer called the KPC, where the RAS and P53 alleles were mutated. And in this model, there's a very large tumor that develops in a few weeks. And when you delete Musashi in this, you get a much smaller tumor. But what the important thing is, actually, it's not just a smaller tumor, it's more benign, because if you look at a cross-section of the wild type versus the knockout, the wild type is all sheets of adenocarcinoma, whereas the knockout still has regions of normal tissue left, and whatever aberrant tissues are arising are in fact all pan-in. So while the wild type has all adenocarcinoma, the knockout has mostly pan-in lesions and no adenocarcinoma, suggesting that these stem cell programs are really critical for powerful mediators like RAS and P53 to take a pre-malignant lesion into a full-on malignancy. So we've also developed reporters to understand how these Musashi-positive cells contribute to disease. So these are knocked in so that cells are positive for Musashi are lit up in green or yellow. So this is GFP or YFP. And you can see that it lights up stem cells, but is not active in differentiated cells. And in the brain, for example, it lights up the hippocampus and SVZ domain, which are enriched for stem and progenitor cells. And it's silent in most of the rest of the mature brain. So what we've done is cross this to the KPC model, again, the pancreatic cancer model, to really highlight the heterogeneity of the cells there. So this shows you that you can, although everything is RAS and P53 mutated, the GFP positive cells and GFP negative cells are pretty clear. And the GFP negative cells are predominantly what the tumor is made of. But the GFP positive cells are a small subset of cells that carry a stem cell program. Now, although they're a minority, in reality, they're more aggressive. So if you take the Musashi report positive and the negative, the report positive makes organoids, the report negative doesn't, and the report positive cells really drive all of the lethality, and the reporter negative cells don't. And finally, if you treat with standard of care chemotherapy like gemcitabine, what you see is that the reporter positive, the stem cell part of the tumor is very small at the outset, but as you treat with the chemo, the reporter negative cells are depleted, the reporter positive cells remain behind. So they're really more resistant to these drugs that are currently used clinically, and they are really the main composition of residual disease or drug-resistant disease. So this is a really potentially powerful platform for identifying drug-resistant cancers. So this is a visual, in fact, like a movie of pancreatic tumors in the KPC model highlighting the stem cells within the cancer. A lot of the blue, and this is, imagine a large sheet, are all RAS P53 mutated. But epigenetically, there's a subset that's activated the stem cell program, and you can see that it's spatially restricted. And when you treat, and that this can be really a good model to identify new programs and pathways that might allow us to eliminate this population along with chemo, which might be better at eliminating sort of the bulk of the tumor. So we've also imaged beyond solid cancers, leukemias. And one of the things that we found in leukemias is that this is using live imaging, so non-invasive imaging, to look inside the native microenvironment to understand how cancers grow. This is just showing you a bone marrow, a view of the bone marrow in a living animal. And you can see sort of the blood vessels lit up and rest of the marrow lit up in blue, and the green are sort of the edges of the bone lit up with a reporter. But the important thing is that when we image leukemia cells, we don't actually find them I mean, they are motile to some extent, but largely also enmeshed within the marrow. So one of the reasons we were doing this is really to understand how much leukemia cells may depend on the microenvironment. What we found is that a lot of leukemic cells are actually enmeshed and interacting with stromal cells and cells of the microenvironment, suggesting that they may utilize interactions with the microenvironment as dependencies. So the reason I mentioned those is really because that led us to looking for Musashi targets. So we knew Musashi was important, but we were really looking for targets that might enable cells to interact with the microenvironment. So we did a screen looking for targets of Musashi in both blast crisis CML and AML. And we looked at common genes that were downstream of Musashi because we knew this was critical, but we really wanted to find other downstream target that could be actionable or could be inhibited by new strategies. So through this, we identified a molecule called tetraspanin-3, and this was downstream of Musashi in both AML and blast crisis CML. It's a large family of four pass transmembrane proteins that can serve as a scaffolding protein and can associate with integrins, allowing a sort of involvement in cell adhesion and proliferation, but very little was really known about it, and none really known about it in cancer. So what we did was we inhibited the tetraspanin protein and showed that either through shRNA or by building a knockout that we developed, you could really gain in survival. So this is survival curve. This is how fast the control mice die of the tumor. And if you inhibit tetraspanin, there's a very clear gain in survival. This is a mouse model. And if you look at patient samples, what you see is if you block it either with the control or you block it with tetraspanin, there's a dramatic reduction in growth of the leukemia when you block this program. So based on this, we have launched a program really targeting tetraspanins in context of leukemia. And these antibodies have now been developed with the help of CIRM and are being vetted and tested in context of both in vitro inhibition of leukemic growth as well as in vivo inhibition. And so just to summarize, what we've really found is that interactions with the local environment can really amplify the impact of intracellular and oncogenic signals on leukemia stem cells and disease propagation, and that targeting these programs like tetraspanin 3 that we've done with the help of CIRM may be more effective as a sort of a combinatorial blockade of both niche signals that support these stem cells or these aberrant aggressive stem cells within cancers, as well as blocking intracellular events, and collectively they may be better able to control disease. So this is just to thank all the people who did the work. So all of the work on Musashi and tetraspanin in leukemia were carried out by Young Kwon and Javisha Bajaj, and others involved in the leukemia side are Kyle Spindler, Yutaka, and Mike Hamilton. And a lot of the testing that was done on these antibodies were done with Yutaka and Emily. And I'd just like to also thank our collaborators, Andy Lowy, as well as Jeff Esko, Mark Ginsberg, Dan Van Hoff, and also thank CIRM for their support of all of our work. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Hello, everyone. My name is Rob Signer, and I'm an assistant professor at UC San Diego in the Division of Regenerative Medicine. And I'd like to start out today just by thanking CIRM for everything that they've done over the past 16 years or so, and to thank the organizers of this meeting and for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to speak today. So my role here today is to tell a story of how CIRM's success isn't only quantified by how quickly and effectively it has accelerated the development of stem cell treatments to patients with unmet clinical needs, but also how it's grown and shaped the field of regenerative medicine by investing in trainees. As you all know, following the passage of Prop 71 in 2004 and the subsequent establishment of CIRM, a first round of funding was issued in 2006 and included a series of training grants that provided funding to predoctoral students as well as postdoctoral and clinical fellows. And as a third-year graduate student at the time at UCLA, I was a proud recipient of a CIRM pre-doctoral fellowship during this inaugural round of funding. The funding I received from CIRM was instrumental in my career development. It helped propel me through my PhD and helped me land a postdoctoral position in stem cell biology in Sean Morrison's lab, which ultimately led me back to California, where I established my own stem cell lab at UC San Diego. Now, the reason I included these pictures on this slide wasn't just to embarrass myself, but because it reflects a central focus of research throughout my career, aging. So what I'll share with you today is how that investment by CIRM in a graduate student 14 years ago has contributed to the development of a new aspect of basic stem cell biology that has some exciting potential for impacting treatments in patients with degenerative and malignant diseases. So the work in my laboratory focuses on how hematopoietic or blood-forming stem and progenitor cells regulate proteostasis. So what is proteostasis? Well, as a word, proteostasis is a portmanteau of the words protein and homeostasis, and the idea that there is a network of biological pathways that regulate both the content and quality of the proteome. These pathways include physiological mechanisms that control protein synthesis, protein folding, protein trafficking, and protein degradation. So why is proteostasis important? Well, the maintenance of proteostasis is really key to ensuring normal development, resistance to environmental stress, coping with infection, and most notably, healthy aging and lifespan. So quite amazingly, genetic or environmental interventions that enhance the capacity to maintain proteostasis will actually extend organismal lifespan in an evolutionarily conserved manner. That is, if you can improve an organism's ability to maintain protein quality, it will actually live a longer and healthier life. In addition, the loss of proteostasis is considered one of the hallmarks of aging, and the accumulation of misfolded proteins is associated with a number of degenerative diseases, most notably neurodegenerative diseases. And the reason that neurons are thought to be particularly susceptible to misfolded proteins is that they are long-lived cells that can no longer divide. And it turns out the best way to eliminate misfolded proteins is by dilution that occurs through cell division. So hematopoietic stem cells are also very long-lived, and they divide very infrequently. So a central hypothesis that drives our research is that stem cells are particularly dependent on the maintenance of proteostasis, and that disruptions in proteostasis contribute to stem cell dysfunction and aging. And overall, we favor the idea that mechanisms that confer organismal longevity are conserved at the cellular level to maintain healthy, long-lived stem cells. And one of the most fascinating things that I hope you take away from this talk today is that many of these mechanisms, which are highly conserved and essential, actually function differently in stem cells than they do in restricted progenitors or other types of cells. So my foray into this arena really began during my postdoctoral fellowship, where I adapted new technology that allowed us to quantify rates of protein synthesis within single cells in vivo. And when we applied this to the hematopoietic system, we found a couple of striking things. The first was, contrary to what most people thought, that protein synthesis is a housekeeping function that's performed similarly by most cells, turns out not to be true, and that different cell types really establish very different rates of protein synthesis that are each maintained at their own homeostatic level. The other striking thing that we observed is that hematopoietic stem cells have unusually low rates of protein synthesis, much lower than many of these restricted progenitors and differentiated cells. And subsequent to our work, low protein synthesis has now been shown to be a conserved feature of stem cells present, as far as I know, in every type of stem cell that people have looked at within adult tissues. So low protein synthesis isn't just a feature of stem cells, but is actually really important for their function. And the way that we figured this out was by using a set of genetic mouse models. The first is where we used a mutation in a ribosomal gene, RPL24, that reduced protein synthesis by between 30 and 40% in stem cells. We also used a mouse where we conditionally deleted the tumor suppressor P10, which is a negative regulator of the PI3 kinase and mTOR signaling pathways, which are known to promote protein synthesis. And then we crossed these two mutations together and found that they could mutually rescue each other. So the ribosomal mutation prevents the increase in protein synthesis that we see with the P10 deletion, and the P10 deletion partially rescues the reduction in protein synthesis that we see with the RPL24 mutation. And when we tested stem cell function within these mice, What we found was that even these small changes in protein synthesis had dramatic effects on stem cell function. So the way we measure stem cell function is by measuring their ability to reconstitute the blood-forming system of an irradiated mouse. And you can see when we transplant just 10 stem cells, the level of reconstitution we get from wild-type cells in the black line. The ribosomal mutant with reduced protein synthesis impairs the regenerative function of stem cells. The P10 deletion, which increases protein synthesis, leads to a total loss of stem cell function. But incredibly, when we put these two mutations together, they mutually rescue each other. And you can see that the level of stem cell activity that we get is comparable to the wild type. And so when I started my lab, we really wanted to understand why these changes in protein synthesis were so detrimental for stem cells. And we went back to considering protein homeostasis, and that we had the idea that increased protein synthesis might increase the generation of misfolded or unfolded proteins. And so we needed a way to figure out how to actually measure these things within small numbers of hematopoietic stem cells. And so we did this using two different approaches. The first is where we measured levels of ubiquitinated protein. So ubiquitinated protein are proteins that are targeted for degradation and consist mostly of misfolded proteins. And you can see here when we compare the level of ubiquitinated or misfolded proteins in stem cells, they have much fewer of these as compared to restricted progenitors. We then also adapted a cell permeable dye that allowed us to quantify unfolded proteins in these cells. And similarly, the stem cells have fewer unfolded proteins than these restricted progenitors. Importantly, this was directly tied to the rate of protein synthesis. So going back to our genetic mouse models, we found that in our P10 deficient mice that have increased protein synthesis, well, they have increased misfolded and unfolded proteins. And when we block this with the ribosomal mutation, we block the increase in protein synthesis, we also block the accumulation of these misfolded and unfolded proteins. And so we really wanted to understand what happens in a stem cell when you accumulate misfolded proteins. And I'm going to tell you one of those small stories right now. And that is that you can activate a stress response pathway, of which there are several in the stem cells. And we focused on this heat shock response, which is actually the central pathway that regulates cytoplasmic proteostasis within cells. So under normal conditions, the heat shock pathway is relatively inactive because it's regulated by a master regulator transcription factor called heat shock factor 1, or HSF1. And under steady state conditions, HSF1 is sequestered in the cytoplasm where it binds to chaperones that assist with protein folding, things like HSP90 or TRC. Now, under conditions of protein stress, these chaperones will actually bind unfolded proteins and allow HSF1 to translocate to the nucleus, where it functions as a transcription factor to drive the expression of things like heat shock proteins that can help to restore proteostasis. So in stem cells where there are very few misfolded proteins, we actually don't really see activation of HSF1. So when we look in the nucleus of young adult hematopoietic stem cells, HSF1 is basically absent. But when we start to look in aging stem cells, we can see HSF1 begin to accumulate within the nucleus of these older hematopoietic stem cells. And this is telling us that aging stem cells are starting to experience protein stress while they age. And surprisingly, we found that one of the functions of HSF1 was to actually suppress increases in protein synthesis in aging stem cells. You can see that here, that when we delete HSF1, the older stem cells show about a 50% increase in their rate of protein synthesis. So is HSF1 actually important for stem cell function? Well, when we look at young adult stem cells, remember these cells have very few misfolded proteins and they don't show activation of HSF1, we can conditionally delete HSF1 from our stem cells and see that there's no effect on stem cell regenerative activity either in a primary transplant or a secondary transplant. But if we aged these mice out, when HSF1 becomes activated, now we can see that HSF1 is in fact important to maintain the regenerative function of aging stem cells. Now, in addition to this role in aging, we found an important role for HSF1 elsewhere that we think has important therapeutic relevance as it comes to stem cells and stem cell transplantation. So one of the biggest limitations in the hematopoietic stem cell field for many years is that we've been unable to effectively culture these cells outside of the body. And we really don't have a good explanation as to why. And one of the things that we found is that a pathway that gets particularly disrupted when we put these stem cells into culture is protein synthesis. So you can see that within 4 hours in culture, hematopoietic stem cells have about a 700% increase in protein synthesis. And within 18 hours, that's about a 2,000% increase, which, if you remember, just a 30% increase in vivo is sufficient to impair stem cells. And consistent with what we saw in aging stem cells, our stem cells in culture also begin to start accumulating HSF1 within their nucleus. So what we did was to test if HSF1 is actually important for maintaining stem cells in culture. And we did this by culturing wild-type or HSF1 deleted stem cells for 10 days. And the way that we do this is to plate just 10 purified stem cells, culture them for a period of 10 days, and then transplant them with wild-type bone marrow into irradiated mice. And you can see here that HSF1 deficiency doesn't impair proliferation of cells in culture, but when we transplant those cells, we see that the HSF1 deficient cells have a severe reduction in their reconstituting ability, telling us that HSF1 activation is actually promoting stem cell maintenance in culture. And so now that we knew that HSF1 is getting activated and is important for stem cell maintenance, we wondered if we could further enhance the activation of HSF1 to support stem cell growth in culture. And the way that we tried to do this was using small molecule inhibitors of HSP90 or TRK, which, remember, these bind to HSF1 and sequester it in the cytoplasm. And we show here that within cultured hematopoietic stem cells, that addition of these inhibitors does indeed lead to a significant enhancement of HSF1 present within the nucleus of these cultured stem cells. And so we did the key experiment where we cultured purified stem cells in the presence of either our vehicle or either the HSP90 inhibitor or the TRK inhibitor, and then we performed serial transplantation experiments. And you can see in primary transplants, the addition of an HSP90 or TRK inhibitor leads to about a twofold increase in the regenerative activity of the stem cells. This is not actually due to stem cell expansion, but we think better maintenance of these stem cells. And the really big difference comes upon secondary transplant, where we now see a threefold or greater increase in the reconstituting activity of these previously cultured stem cells, indicating to us that the HSP90 inhibitor or TRK inhibitor are really enhancing the maintenance of stem cell fitness in culture. Finally, I'll show you that the effect of these small molecules is in fact due to HSF1 activation. So if we repeat all of these experiments using HSF1 deficient cells, now all of a sudden the HSP90 inhibitor no longer has any effect on stem cell regenerative activity. And the same is true for the TRK inhibitor. And the last piece of data that I'll show you today is that many of these mechanisms that we've observed initially with mouse stem cells are actually appear to be conserved with human stem cells. So when we culture human cord blood derived hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells, we see that they also exhibit a rapid and massive increase in protein synthesis, and they activate HSF1. And I can tell you also that these small molecules have the same effect on human stem cells to enhance HSF1 activation. And we're excited to continue studying this in the context of human cells. So with that, let me just thank all the people that did this work. And in particular, leading our protein quality study was Lorena Hidalgo, a former postdoc, and leading our HSF1 study is a former postdoc, Miriam Makruta. And thanks to everyone, all our collaborators, all our funders, and to CIRM for everything that they've done. And thank you all for your attention.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for having me today. I'm here to talk to you about neural stem cell targeted anti-cancer therapies going from bench to bedside, and also show you some of the work that CIRM has enabled us to do through their grant funding. So stem cells are regenerative. I'm sure you've heard a lot about that today. They can regenerate skin, blood, bone, heart, nerves. I show this cartoon that you can be anything you want to be when you grow up. And it's the researcher's goal to push the cells in the direction that they want. You can turn these stem cells into heart, beating heart cells, into nerves, into skin tissue. However, what I looked at the stem cells for is not regenerative, but that they are also pathotropic. What I mean by that is that the stem cells are attracted to areas of pathology. And I was a cancer researcher, so I was interested to know, are they attracted to cancer cells, right? Cancer cells invade tissue, they do damage. Would the stem cells go there? So just to give you an overview, a lot of the work being done now by CIRM investigators and others is stem cell replacement. There are trials on macular degeneration going on now where they actually inject the stem cells into the eye to replace the damaged cells in the eye and restore vision. Remyelination, to remyelinate nerves that are damaged with spinal cord injury. So again, stem cells from when you're born, as you develop, they know how to do all these things and make normal nerves and normal eye cells and heart tissue. But when it gets damaged later on, can you put the stem cells there and regenerate the tissue? Since they knew how to do it when you were developing, can they do it now? Or trick the environment into regenerating the tissue? So promotion of host tissue regeneration, we're looking at stroke, Parkinson's disease, ALS, cell replacement. So again, those are all regenerative properties of stem cells. What I'm looking at is pathotropism, or in this case, tumor tropism, that the stem cells are in fact attracted to invading tumor cells. And if they are, can we localize the treatment only to the tumor cells and then avoid off-target toxic effects? So what I discovered about, 20 years ago, is that neural stem cells, so these are stem cells that have already been committed to becoming brain cells, different cells in the brain. So neural stem cells, they have an inherent ability to track down cancer cells. So this is not something I did to them, it was something I observed. They can cross the blood-brain barrier to the brain. And since they can track down cancer cells, I'm using them as a delivery vehicle to deliver different therapeutic payloads directly to the tumor sites. And in this way, normal tissues are spared from the toxic side effects and reducing suffering and improving quality of life. For example, when a patient gets chemo intravenously, the chemo is killing everything that's dividing quickly. It doesn't distinguish between your tumor cells and, for instance, your hair cells or your bone marrow or your skin, which is why you get so many side effects. It's killing everything that's dividing quickly. In this case, if we can activate the chemotherapy only at the tumor sites, we would avoid all those other effects. And that was the goal, to improve quality of life. So early studies that we did, this is a model where there's a tumor in the brain. The tumor is the dark red. And a surgeon can go ahead and remove the tumor in the brain. We looked at brain tumors first, but the surgeon will miss cells that already invaded into the normal tissue. And unlike liver or lung, you can't remove part of the brain tissue. So the question is, you can remove the tumor, but how do you get those invading cells without hurting the rest of the brain? On the left, it shows that the NSCs here, they're dyed blue, that when we inject the stem cells into a tumor, they don't just sit there, they move. They love the tumor environment. They distribute all over the tumor. Also, they cross normal tissue to follow invading tumor cells. And in the right panel, we see tumors always are taking over blood vessels to feed itself so it can spread. And as you can see, the stem cells love these new blood vessels too. So it seems like whatever's making the tumor more aggressive, more invasive, is also attracting these neural stem cells. So over the years, we've used stem cells as a platform to target several different anti-cancer agents directly to invasive cancer cells. We've done this in models of glioma, medulloblastoma, metastasis to the brain. This is an increasing population. There's over 180,000 new cases a year of brain metastasis because as our treatments have gotten better systemically, for example, for lung cancer, breast cancer, more and more patients are presenting with brain mets because a lot of these chemotherapies and drugs do not cross the blood-brain barrier. So patients are presenting that way now. Also, if we inject the stem cells intravenously, they will cross the blood-brain barrier and localize to tumor sites. Finally, and this is a more recent grant that I'll talk about, neural stem cells, when they're injected intravenously or into the abdomen, they will localize to metastatic cancers throughout the body, including breast carcinoma, neuroblastoma, and ovarian cancer. So these cells will stop at the tumor sites. They're recognizing something in the tumor vasculature, and they'll penetrate into the tumor. So again, I didn't do anything to the stem cells to make them tumor-tropic. This is what we observed and discovered. What we're doing is adding a therapeutic payload to carry it directly to the tumor sites. So we started with brain tumor therapy, and brain tumor treatment today, there have been advances in surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. However, despite all those advances, these tumors are virtually incurable and lethal. Why? Well, there's no clear boundaries of these tumors. By the time they're diagnosed, they've already spread away from one primary mass. And when tumors spread away from the main tumor site, that's invasive or metastases. Again, the chemotherapies do not cross the blood-brain barrier well. About 98% of them don't get through. And when they do get through, there's poor tumor penetration. So there has not been a significant advance. The prognosis is about 2 years from the time of diagnosis and only 6 months, 6 to 8 months from when it recurs. So what our lab did is we developed a neural stem cell line for clinical use. And allogeneic means that we can use this one line and apply it to many different people, to all different patients. Autologous is when they take it from the patient and give it back to the same patient. But we were looking for an off-the-shelf product, something that can be frozen down in vials and then used as needed for the different patients. And we've characterized this. They're frozen down at City of Hope GMP facility, which is for clinical products. They're minimally immunogenic, so they don't get rejected very easily. It's expandable. So we've engineered this cell line so that we do not need new tissue. We do not need to go back to any new characterization. Every vial of these cells has exactly the same thing. Now, these stem cells can be modified further with different therapeutic payloads. And we were the first to take this to human trials with an off-the-shelf NSC line to deliver a therapeutic agent. And our first therapy was NSC, neural stem cell mediated enzyme prodrug gene therapy. And this is what I had mentioned, that the stem cells will go to the tumor site, that we've engineered them to make an enzyme that does nothing by itself. But now when you give an inactive prodrug, and that does cross to the brain, the enzyme will convert it to the active drug, the chemotherapeutic, only in the area where the tumors are. So the stem cells are administered, they localize to the tumor, they make their enzyme, we give an inactive prodrug, so now you have localized chemotherapy production because it's only going to be made where the stem cells are, and the stem cells are only where the tumor sites are. Now, CIRM gave me an $18 million disease team award in 2010 to take a brand new NSC treatment to patients with glioma. This was how we did it. We took our stem cells, we engineered them to make an enzyme. In this case, it's called CE. Then we treat the patient with irinotecan, and then the stem cell enzyme converts it to a drug called SN38. This is 3,000 times more potent, more anti-cancer effect than irinotecan alone. And we're only localizing it to the tumor sites, so this toxic drug is not going through the whole body and not affecting normal tissues. It's only being made where the tumor is. Now, one of the things besides getting to clinical trial, I think we have one patient left on this clinical trial, is the funding from CIRM enabled us to get additional funding based on what we discovered. And we did get $2 million from NIH to conduct the clinical trial. And we also got almost $5 million from NIH to apply this same treatment that we developed for brain tumor, the exact same cell product, for metastatic neuroblastoma injected intravenously. And this will be going to clinical trial hopefully within the next 6 months. So it's just to point out that what CIRM has enabled us to do in our original proposal has had ramifications for other tumors and other payloads. So we did do a phase one. As I said, we have one patient left, dose escalation, multi-dose trial. The patients come in with recurrent glioma, the surgeon removes the tumor, and then the stem cells that are making the CE are injected into the resection cavity wall. And 2 centimeters around the wall is where most of the recurrent tumor happens. But again, I showed you there's going to be distant tumor sites that the surgeon will miss. And we believe our stem cells migrate to those distant sites also. So now you have the stem cells localized to the tumor sites, and we give the irinotecan drug. And now we make that SN38, that powerful chemotherapeutic, only at the tumor sites. We also have, a City of Hope has an alpha clinic, a SIRM alpha clinic. So we leave a catheter in under the skull if the patient doesn't show, but that way they can come in every month or every 2 weeks to get another dose of stem cells and the drug. So we can give repeat treatment rounds. Our clinical trials so far have demonstrated that the stem cells are moving to distant tumor sites, even in the opposite side of the brain, and they are converting the prodrug to the active chemotherapeutic. So we have proof of concept. Again, these initial phase one trials are for safety. They're quite small, but once they're finished, we can move to phase two, larger studies and increasing dosing. And then I wanted to just finish with a new translational grant that we were awarded. We went to clinical trial with an oncolytic virotherapy, so the same stem cells, but now they're making an oncolytic virus. This virus will infect tumor cells. It will keep dividing till it bursts the tumor cell open, and then it will spread to the next tumor cells and the next tumor cells, and it should keep amplifying until it hits normal tissue. This is important because even if the tumor cells are chemo-resistant or radiation-resistant, it's effective. There are many trials with free virus. Free virus gets neutralized by the immune system. It doesn't reach the tumor sites well, and it doesn't penetrate well. And we also can't give multiple treatment rounds because of the immune system. By encasing the virus in the stem cells and let the stem cells protect it on its way to the tumor sites, we can get more of the virus to the tumor site, and we can give multiple rounds of treatment. So the grant that we have just received in February is for ovarian cancer. 22,000 women per year are affected. Stage 3 ovarian cancer is when the tumor cells are in the abdomen, and many of after treatment with cisplatin, paclitaxel, they become resistant to the chemo. So we wanted to try this same product of the oncolytic virus into the ovarian cancer. And what we have shown so far is that the stem cells here, they're red and orange. These are tumor sites. When we inject them intraabdominally, they localize to the ovarian tumor sites, to multiple ovarian tumor sites throughout the abdomen. They're not localizing to normal tissue, kidney or liver. So they'll be at the tumor sites. They'll be making their oncolytic virus. They'll infect the tumor cells, lyse them, release more virus. And again, we hope to get an amplifying effect until the tumors are gone. So this is the $2.8 million SIRM-TRAN, and that is to get us to the point of submission to the FDA for a clinical trial with this oncolytic virus neural stem cells to go into stage 3 ovarian cancer patients. And I just want to thank SIRM. I want to thank my lab who does all the work. I just get to present it. And all our clinicians, brain tumor and ovarian cancer. And again, SIRM has enabled us to go from basic science to translational to the clinic. It's a big team effort, and it is an expensive effort. And we're very grateful to have gotten funding and to be able to do this. Thank you so much. I'll take your questions.
I've always been interested in some of the issues with oncolytic viruses, which are kind of the ultimate precision immunotherapy in a way. But, you know, as I'm sure you know, after the melanoma oncolytic virus was approved by the FDA, there's been really a lot of, I mean, nothing else is that I know of is even close. I know that the Duke group has been working with, you know, a GBM oncolytic virus, but, it's pretty slow going. So two questions, you know, maybe you can help us understand why it's been so difficult to move oncolytic viruses to the clinic. And then two, I couldn't resist, but do you think we'll be able to make some sort of oncolytic virus out of COVID?
I think it has had a rocky start into the clinic, and a lot of they're not seeing the efficacy that we were hoping to see with the free virus. And I think that's a lot of the problem is the neutralization by the antibodies and not getting enough of the virus to the tumor sites. So we're actually now collaborating with several companies that already have free virus in the clinic and trying to see if we deliver that virus with stem cells, are we going to improve the efficacy of the clinical trial? So we're looking at that. And then what was the other question?
Well, the other question was the C word.
COVID, yeah.
With all of the study that's going on with COVID, with SARS-2, beyond any I've ever seen before, everything about it, every new receptor, temperature, and so on, I wonder if out of all that science will come a way to create, you know, an oncolytic vector maybe for lung cancer or something.
Yeah, absolutely. So actually we're looking at, since the stem cells are making anti-inflammatory exosomes as well, the stem cells themselves may work for the ARDS. But the fact that you can engineer these viruses to anything, you know, even the checkpoint inhibitors. So this is a way to target different therapies directly to these inflammatory sites. So I do think that's already in play of engineering, but there's so many different viruses out there. We're trying to do some comparative studies. Sorry, that's my puggle. Adeno, myxoma, the chimeric pox viruses, herpes virus. So there's so many. I think we still have to figure out which virus is most effective for which cancer. But then they can be engineered to deliver anti-COVID anything. And I think they're doing that now.
Wonderful. Thank you. Sandra, what advice would you have for any person now that's considering stem cell therapy, particularly in an investigational setting? What advice do you have?
I would say that, my disease, it pushed me towards this because, I really felt like I was trying to survive. And even if you're pushed in a position where, it's like you feel you might not have any other choice, you're still afraid of other aspects of what's going on. I certainly came into my treatment with a lot of fear around the process of being treated, all of the poking and the prodding and the tests. And I would say that expressing that with your doctor and the teams that are going to be working with you is really important, because there's ways to overcome those fears, and certainly there were a lot of tests that I was very afraid of, and we found ways to make it, make things okay. And along that process, I really learned how much it's a partnership, and how much it's a community of people that are working together, to create like these really amazing new treatments. And so it's okay to be afraid, and it's really important to express what's going on with you, because there's a lot that your experiences, your side effects, all of that is kind of essential knowledge to your doctor and to your treatment team. So I'd say communication, honesty with your own fear, and knowing that these folks are here to really do whatever they can to give you a shot and give you a chance to go forward. And this is just incredibly exciting research. It's unbelievable to me.
Well, you definitely got great intel to end up with Dr. Jameson. I'm sure that helped a little. yes. So Tanishta, we'll go to you next. So excited to hear your interest in precancer with panins and so on. Can you give a sense, since you've really done some of the really early seminal work on the whole concept of a cancer stem cell before it was really accepted, and your big paper did a lot to catalyze that. The role of Musashi or cancer stem cells in general in early, pre-invasive, pre-malignant disease compared to, let's say, metastases. Is there a sense of where cancer stem cells may act more prominently, or is it, you know, very specific to the cell and the disease?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I think some of our work early on, and especially right now, we're in the middle of a project really tracking how cancers arise and what cells they arise from, seems to indicate that they initiate also from cells that are high for stem cell programs and progenitor-like states, and that those particular cells within a panin or an early stage precancerous lesion are particularly primed to move forward and particularly sensitive to transformation. So, you know, they do change over time as they evolve, but through each of those steps, it seems like the cells that are particularly enriched for those programs are particularly your riskiest cells in terms of promoting transition or progression to the next stage and full-on malignancies. So that's sort of what we're seeing in pancreatic cancer, and others have done some of that work in leukemia as well.
So in terms of interactions with immune cells and targets, and particularly genomic determinants of tumorigenesis from P53 to, you know, copy number alterations, mm-hmm. how do those interact? What do we know about the interaction of those and stem cells in, you know, the tumorigenesis process, particularly the early?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some sort of really interesting intersection between the genomic changes and the epigenetic changes. And what we're seeing from really recent upcoming work is that there's sort of a baseline mutation that occurs that starts to, you know, propagate through the cells. But there's in addition to those genomic changes and copy number changes, which accrue over time, there's epigenetic changes that essentially specify the particular state of the cell, and that when you have the mutation and that epigenetic state, you're particularly resistant and you're particularly able to take the precancerous lesion into the next stage or resist therapies at a late stage tumor. So it's some, I think, collective event that leads to this cancer stem cell state or the particularly aggressive drug resistant state that is the most aggressive and dangerous, essentially, to cancer, and really needs to be controlled at the level of additional strategies on top of the usual chemotherapy and radiation.
Great. We do have a question on oncolytic viruses, but I want to first go to Rob Signer. So a lot of us aren't that familiar with proteostasis. I'm embarrassed to say I'm not, and I know you've explained it to me a lot. It's a pretty complicated concept, I think. What is the clinical implications of that work, or what are you thinking in terms of next steps to get this into clinic to help patients?
So thanks, Scott, for the question. It's, you know, I think it has multiple clinical implications. You know, in regards directly to our work on the effect of stem cells in culture, I think that we can start to develop new ways to better grow, maintain, and expand hematopoietic stem cells in culture that can support better transplantation programs. So making stem cells more widely available to donors that might not have, to patients who might not have available donors for those stem cells, or in the context of, you know, gene therapy or gene editing technologies, where the addition of molecules that can enhance protein homeostasis, that you actually get better quality stem cells out the other end. And transplanting, you know, better stem cells and larger numbers of stem cells can help to reduce, you know, some of the failure that can occur with transplantation or some of those effects. At the same time, everything we're understanding about proteostasis regulation within normal stem cells, we're now also adapting to study in the context of malignant stem cells and in cancer, and identifying new therapeutic vulnerabilities in that way. And so we just got a new big grant in order to target aspects of protein synthesis within cancer stem cells that we think can provide a new unique therapeutic opportunities that haven't really been looked at carefully quite yet.
Great, thanks, Rob. So Karen, question to you about oncolytic viruses. The question is, can tumors develop resistance or immunity to oncolytic viruses like they can with other drugs? And what do we know about that?
Yes, you will get an immune response to the virus. So when you give it free, you can get one round in. With the stem cells, preclinically, we're seeing we can get two or three rounds in, but you're still releasing the virus and eventually you're still getting an immune response to it. We're just getting more of it to the tumor site, so it's working more until the immune system neutralizes it. We're looking at combination oncolytic viral therapies now, preclinically. I think you're gonna have to, just like a cocktail of chemo, a cocktail of different viruses. What we're looking at is when we use the oncolytic virus that's in clinical trial now, what's left? What are the tumor cells that escaped it to begin with? And what's the next thing we need to hit it with to get rid of it? So I don't think, I don't see a silver bullet yet. But the good thing about the immune response, the oncolytic virus, it's like biphasic response. So first it's killing the tumor cells because it's just dividing, the virus keeps dividing in the tumor cells still till it bursts it open, lyses. So it's okay for chemo-resistant cells and radio-resistant cells. But now we see that there's a secondary longer-term effect where you're getting an immune response to all those new antigens that were exposed by the tumors. So you get a secondary immunotherapy response. I don't think that's characterized super well yet, especially in the clinic. But to answer your question again, I think it's going to be a cocktail of different viruses, either sequentially or given at the same time. But we're hoping to get two or three rounds in. Yeah.
Great. And there's a few more questions for you, Karen. Great talk, it says, which I agree. So the issue of delivery, this issue about delivery of the oncolytic virus through the NSC, and you know, how could that relate to NSC-derived exosomes for neuroblastoma or neurological disorders? And then finally, could you compare the therapeutic potential between the NSCs from iPSCs versus OSC or other NSCs? A lot of acronyms, but you know those.
So, all right, so that we're using the stem cells to produce the virus, right? So the stem cells are the producer cell line for the virus. So it depends what indication you want to use it for. The exosomes that the stem cells are always producing, we're characterizing them now and profiling them, but obviously there's a lot of anti-inflammatory properties of the exosomes. I wasn't aware of all the exosome fields until this past couple of years. So we are looking at that. What does the exosomes do in the context of cancer? But really we want to look at them in the context of dementia or Alzheimer's or wherever there's chemo brain, wherever there's inflammation in the brain. And then as it compares to other neural stem cell types, I honestly think you have to characterize whatever you're working with. I think it's different from lab to lab and company to company. The reason I originally made these neural stem cells immortalized and clonal, it's a normal female karyotype, is so that in my preclinical animal experiments, I'm using the same thing every time. It's not changing over passage, it's not changing over time. So when I change all my therapeutic variables, I know at least the stem cells are consistent. Later, I brought them to clinical trial because it seemed like they're so characterized. And just to give an example, like mesenchymal stem cells will lose their tumor-tropic properties after five passages. So as for iPSCs and ONSCs, I think you have to characterize the population you have and you have to make sure that it's consistent in its function over time and passage. But I think everybody's working with something different. I mean, you change the media, you change the plastics that you're using, it's changing the profile of the exosomes and it's changing the profile of your stem cells. So anybody who's looking to go to clinical trial, you really, the more you can do preclinically to characterize and get what's stable, the easier it'll be when you move it to the clinic.
Yeah, actually, you know, I was wondering, you know, in the context of oncolytic viruses, there seems to be a lot of interest in brain tumors, GBM. You know, the Duke vaccine, and there's, the Duke oncolytic virus, and there's work Jeremy Rich has published with the Zika virus as a vehicle for brain tumors. Is there a reason why there seems to be a lot of focus on brain tumors? I mean, those are the most promising ones, Duke, and the work you're doing. It's all brain tumor.
Several reasons. One, brain tumors are resistant to chemo. All right, by the time we get to treat, by the time it's recurrent, right, they've already failed surgery, chemo, and radiation. So you need a way to kill them, like by lysis from the inside out, that won't be resistant to. But secondly, I mean, I don't know how to say this in a recurrent glioma, patients have 6 months left to live. They have no other treatment. There's no standard of care. So in a way, it's the fastest route to getting an oncolytic virus into the clinic. It's the most promising, I think, for brain tumors, but it's also only a first indication. I do think these oncolytic viruses that they're trying in brain tumors, actually, we just got a CIRM TRAN grant. So the oncolytic virus that we're putting in newly diagnosed glioma patients at Northwestern, we're using the same product now since it showed safety, and we're gonna go to phase two to see if there's efficacy. Use the same product for ovarian cancer, because it turns out they also respond to it. So I think it's just the initial path in.
Great, thank you. So there's only one more question that's come up. So if people have others, please send them. This is for Dr. Rhea. Any insights into architecture of pancreatic tumor with Masashi positive cells in the center? What causes that? Or what is the significance of that? Those are the questions.
Thanks, Scott. So, you know, we're really interested in that because I think when we first did the imaging, we thought the stem cells would be disseminated throughout the tumor, but for some reason they were spatially restricted in these domains. And they do have high levels of a lot of adhesion molecules that seem to be restricted those to those cells or enriched in those cells relative to the non-stem cell fraction. I've also talked to folks at UCSF who study sort of the glycocalyx, and there's some possibility that there's sort of this covering essentially around those cells that may make them more resistant or associate differentially with the microenvironment. I don't really have an answer, but I can say that those things are enriched in those cells, and they're also highly mucinous and mucin producing. So we don't really know exactly why they're spatially restricted, but it's possible that because of that, there's also a microenvironment around them that is particularly protective of their drug resistant state. but that is an area that we're investigating right now.
Thank you. So there is one more, but I guess, well, before I ask that, if there are questions that any of the speakers have or other speakers, open it up after this. And so this is to you, Karen, I think. Is it known whether these NSCs also target immune cells as well as the cancer cells in the tumor?
We're looking at, I don't know if they target, they target the cancer cells, the invading cancer cells. What we're looking at now is the stromal cells and the surrounding populations. So we are trying to profile what else is targeted. But I'm looking at it more for the virus. So if the virus, let the virus target the stromal cells also, not just the tumor cells. It's what we're looking at with David Curiel with the CRAD viruses.
Okay. It makes me think of a question just that you may have mentioned, Tanishta. You know, in pancreatic cancer, the stroma is obviously very problematic, that, you know, the desmoplastic reaction, essentially leather covering viable tumor cells in the pancreas. And that's a challenge, obviously, getting chemotherapy in. How will the your Masashi work and the agency develop following that lead? How do you plan to sort of work around, you know, that dense stroma to get to the pancreatic tumor cell?
I mean, we haven't directly looked. I mean, I think there's some data now that it's not a situation where the stroma is resistant to anything, rather there are molecular agents or particular cell types that can make their way through the microenvironment. Although clearly, I think there's also papers that show that if the chemotherapy is delivered locally, it's much more effective. So what I can say is that when we have tested at least tool agents against Masashi or other markers of stem cells or other mediators of stem cells, we have seen efficacy both in autochthonous models as well as patient-derived xenografts. So we're, you know, obviously aware that the microenvironment plays a role in reducing efficacy. But I think the data in the field is emerging that it's not sort of a pan blockade of everything as much as it may block some cells and not others. And then parts of the stroma might be inhibitory and parts may be sort of tumor promoting and some may inhibit the tumor. So it's sort of a complex emerging field. But everything we've tried is usually tested in context of an autochthonous model where the microenvironment is intact.
There is actually one more while you're thinking for Tanishta. Does MSI directly bind T-SPAN3 RNA, or is it binding to a gene epistatic to T-SPAN3?
Yeah, it actually is a direct target of Musashi. So when we initially did the work, we were looking for direct targets that might be on the surface and may be targetable using an antibody strategy. So this was one of them that actually not only was downstream and being blocked when Musashi was gone, but it rose when Musashi was delivered and has Musashi binding sites. So it is a direct target in terms of binding, Musashi binding the tetraspan and RNA and regulating its expression or translation and stability. And the work that we're doing with CIRM is really to develop a therapeutic antibody against tetraspanin in order to be able to target the stem cell fraction, both in leukemia and possibly other cancers, using that strategy. So it is as direct a target as we've seen in either pancreas or in leukemia work that we've done.
Thanks to all of our four wonderful speakers. Incredible session on cancer stem cells. I know I learned a lot. So thanks to everyone for presenting and for everyone that attended through Zoom. Thanks very much.